This Studio Sacramento episode is supported by UC Davis Health, where doctors, nurses, and researchers share a passion for advancing health. Learn more about their latest medical innovations at health.ucdavis.edu.
Welcome to another virtual episode of Studio Sacramento. The University of California at Davis has been at the center of this region's efforts in confronting the COVID-19 pandemic. Two of its leaders, UC Davis Chancellor Dr. Gary May and UC Davis Health CEO David Lebarski, join us. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Chancellor, what has this pandemic presented you and your team in terms of how you've had to adapt?
Well, you know, Scott, a university has three fundamental aspects of its mission. That's teaching its students, performing and conducting research, and public service. And this pandemic has fundamentally altered all three aspects of our mission in profound ways. Our students are now being taught remotely using online technology. The campus is fundamentally empty, except for people that are essential workers. Our research activity has ramped down significantly, and hopefully we could get that back up soon, because we think that's very important. And our public service mission has done a shift to addressing the issues that have been raised by the pandemic. And that's everything from the research to counter the actual disease to the public service that we do to help people in need because of the disease, to making sure our workers are taken care of and our students are taken care of in their remote locations, and you know, all the various mental health and other issues that entails. So really this pandemic has turned the university upside down in many ways.
Wow. Dr. Lebarski, what are you and your team focused on right now?
Well, right now we are focused on making sure that we are 100% ready for a surge that we hope will never come. Right now, the people of Sacramento have done an amazing job in staying at home and sheltering in place and not giving each other COVID-19. And so right now, the region is in incredibly good shape in terms of the readiness of not only us, but our partner health systems if volumes increase. So we've spent the last month, 2 months doing this, and now we're actually beginning to pivot slightly, saying, okay, for how long can we afford to continue to put off essential health care of others while we are focused on COVID-19? How much of our hospital capacity do we need to keep empty for a surge that may not come? And how important is it for patients and doctors to deal with other diseases other than COVID-19? And so we're beginning, Governor Newsom has done, is to try and create a framework now about how do we continue and how do we recover, perhaps, from the COVID-19 decrease in healthcare we provided.
It's interesting you talk about preparing for the surge, because there's been a discussion as to whether the surge is coming, whether we're underprepared, overprepared. What's the truth on the ground?
Well, first of all, there's no such thing as being overprepared. All you have to do is look to New York or Louisiana, and there's no such thing as overprepared. We've, again, great local leadership, Mayor Steinberg, Peter Bailenson for County Healthcare Services, and Governor Newsom, along with Sonia Angel and Mark Galley, all have been extremely strong in making sure they took early and definitive and decisive action to keep us safe. And hopefully, and they're being very careful about thoughts around relaxation. So I don't think overprepared is, we were prepared in case some of those did not work as well. Our epidemic here in the Sacramento region or the San Francisco region is different than that in LA. And again, they, each area, again, could not guarantee that they would not see a big surge. But it doesn't seem like that big surge is coming, Scott. Doesn't seem that we are going, we've had about the same number of patients for the last couple of weeks. And so we're very happy with that. And now we're saying, okay, It's time to take care of people with diabetes. UC Davis Health just got its comprehensive stroke center certification, so we'll be getting most complex strokes in the region. And how are we going to take care of those patients? And how do we do right by them? Because, like I said, we're not a one disease organization.
Sure. Chancellor May, going back to preparation and whether there's ever such a thing as over preparation, take us back about a month or so ago when you had to make the decision to shut down the university. Go through that process with us on what you were thinking. Sure. And what outcomes you were seeking.
Yeah, it really goes back to when the first patient who'd been infected by what's referred to as community spread was admitted into the hospital. And we started, the disease became real to us. We always had been observing from afar what was going on other places. But when we got that patient, and then shortly thereafter, we had a student who became a person under investigation because that student had exhibited symptoms, and we had to isolate the student and the roommates of that student. And so that started the ball rolling in terms of making this transition. We, as the contagion spread, our first decision was to give faculty what we called complete flexibility in moving their courses online and increasing social distancing in their classrooms and that sort of thing. And from there, we made a decision to make our final exam period completely online. And then after the finals were over, we went to complete remote instruction. Now, the campus is not closed. We call it suspended operation because some things have to happen. Animals have to be cared for. Various other infrastructure things go on, whether or not students are physically present. So, but we are in suspended operation and we'll be that way through the end of spring quarter and likely through summer quarter now. And that means the students are receiving their instruction remotely via various online technologies. And that was a significant decision because we had never done this before. Many faculty required some assistance in getting their courses ready for this mode. Students, by and large, had not received instruction in this way before. So, quite a bit of work had to be done to make that happen. And my hat's off to our faculty, by the way. This is not easy to convert a course from a traditional mode of instruction to an online mode. And they've really been exceptional in their performance in that activity.
I'm curious, Chancellor, how many ways is the university involved in fighting the pandemic? It's obvious that the medical center and the medical school are, but are there other aspects of the school involved?
Yeah, it's really been kind of one of the bright spots has been the cooperation that we've had between Davis campus and the Sacramento Health campus in finding various ways to address the pandemic. For anything from, very early on, all of our, many of our laboratories in Davis shipped personal protective equipment over to the hospital and the medical center. Our engineering folks have been 3D printing ventilator parts and swabs for the testing. And there's about 300 person, maybe more because 300 is the limit of Zoom, but there's a 300 person group of researchers, we call it the COVID-19 research group at UC Davis, that's been meeting regularly. They meet once a week to talk about ways they can address the pandemic. They've developed a tracking mechanism, for example, to follow the clusters of where the contagion is going. And of course, David can tell you about the work in clinical trials and other things to treat the patients. So it's really been an enlightening and a positive aspect of what is really a terrible situation to see how UC Davis has come together.
Dr. Lebarski, I am curious about that. What work is going on with regards to clinical trials and trying to find a vaccine to put this to bed forever?
Right. So we've got a lot of different research objectives and teams working on this, as Chancellor May said. And before I even get started on that, he kind of glossed over what the labs gave us stuff. That was our lifeline. At a time when the supply chain was critically broken, we were able to assure the safety of our staff, our patients, and our trainees because of the generous donations of every single glove and mask and gown that this organization had. And now the supply chain, I mean, we have plenty of personal protective equipment. We're in no risk at all of running out. However, without their help at the very beginning, when every supply chain was stretched, we would have been stretched. So incredibly important to allow us to continue to operate in a safe manner. Having said that, the collaborations across the campus, I'm going to touch on a couple. Again, when we were facing the fact that we might not have enough N95 masks, and we were really trying to figure out, well, how are we going to protect people who are in the room with the sickest of the COVID-19 patients? And we worked on actually adapting a scuba mask, and we needed to 3D print a part that would allow the connection of a scrubbing filter to sufficient to get rid of COVID-19 to the scuba mask. And the engineering department stepped up and figured out how to do that and produce these. And so God forbid we ever run out of N95 masks, we have a couple thousand scuba masks that are ready to go and fully protective that we can deploy. And it's always good to have a plan B when plan A is stretched. Other examples of things like that in the engineering department, they're again, but the most important stuff that I think your viewers want to hear about is like, what are the clinical treatments and why are we, what are we pursuing and why? One of the most promising is Gilead's drug, remdesivir, which has been given out for compassionate use. It was used during the treatment of one of our first patients. Of course, one patient means nothing, but the New England Journal just published the results of the first study on that drug, and it seems 68% had some improvement. So that's a positive sign. We're involved in that NIH trial. We have been actively recruiting, as have many other organizations across the United States. That drug, what it does is it prevents the virus from replicating, from duplicating itself in your body. And its mode of action and its effectiveness in coronavirus was actually first discovered at the veterinary school at UC Davis. And so, which is a fascinating kind of come all around full circle. Another drug we're involved in, which is another NIH trial, is something called an IL-6 inhibitor. Your audience doesn't need to understand anything about that except to say that the pneumonia that overwhelms elderly people and even some young people as a cause of death is due to an immense immune reaction, an overzealous immune reaction inside of the lung to the virus. This, the thing that causes that overzealous reaction is known as interleukin-6 or IL-6, and this drug inhibits that. So it stops that big immune response and prevents the pneumonia from becoming full blown. And that also has some promise. There are a couple other drugs that we're beginning to look on that we're investigating on our own. Those two are parts of large national trials. And then we're working on some novel, using our animal labs, our virologists, our incredible genome sequencing people in our Genomics Institute. We're working on our own version of the vaccine as well. But that is not around the corner. So we're not going to see that anytime soon.
That is what I think that most of us want to know. What's realistic in terms of when it is that we might actually see a vaccine?
The earliest possible trial of a vaccine in a larger than test subject population will probably be late fall, early winter of this year, according to the NIH. Will not be ready for the public. They may try it out on emergency room staff who have repetitive exposures to COVID-19 or the flu season to be associated with an increase in COVID-19 in November and December. The public probably will not see anything for a minimum of 12 months. And for sure, by summertime of 2021, we should have a working vaccine.
It's an interesting point, Chancellor May, because based on Dr. Lebarsky's timeline, that really eats into the academic year of the university and frankly, the entire UC system. What is it that you're anticipating you're going to have to be prepared for given those emerging facts?
Well, we've already made the decision that the summer sessions, the two summer sessions, will be remote instruction as we're doing this spring. And we just formed or in the process of forming a working group to advise us on what we should think about for the fall, because I think even if we are successful in the social distancing and the quarantine activities that we have now, we're not going to go back to what we had previously for quite some time. So we have to think about how do we put students in dormitories, for example. How do they eat properly in the dining hall so that they're doing it safely? What do we do with classrooms and social distancing? How do we make sure that our faculty, who many of whom are in the vulnerable groups, over 60, how do we make sure that they are also safe from the virus? So there's lots of, and then finally, we want to be able to bring up the research back to somewhere close to normalcy. So there are lots of things we have to consider with this working group, and we're just kicking that activity off now. Some universities, as you may have heard, have already decided that their fall quarter or fall semester will be online as well, and they won't try to resume normal activity until January of 2021. That's certainly a possibility for the UC. We haven't made that decision yet, but that's something we have to consider as well.
Dr. Lebarski, we use the word normal, getting back to normal. Are we ever getting back to normal at this point? And I realize that that's speculation, but is this like a 9/11 moment where the nation, the world has permanently changed?
I think it's changed. I don't think it's permanently changed in the way that 9/11 changed us. Literally, travel became an ordeal, and it never stopped being an ordeal. It's a little bit better now, right? If you get pre-check, you don't have to take your shoes off. Right, exactly, a little bit. For those of us who travel a lot, it's still an ordeal and it is not a joy. And so that really did change travel for many of us for a lifetime. I don't think that this is what we're gonna see. We will get back to normal for over the next 12 to 16 months, and it will not be normal in the sense as Governor Newsom said, you know, normal it will not be, right? It's a new normal, but it will fade away. As soon as we have a vaccine, our estimate is that about 55% of individuals need to either be vaccinated with a good response or have experienced the disease in order to create a community immunity that will allow us to congregate again in stadiums and everything else. So I'm sure we're going to get back to normal, right? It may just won't be in the next couple of months.
Talking about that community or herd immunity, the other side of that coin that there's been a lot of talk in the press about has been about rolling pandemics in terms of reoccurrence. How is it that you and your colleagues are thinking about that in terms of how we address that until that great day when a vaccine is available?
Right, so there are a lot of models out there and a lot of talk about how do we sort of get back to normal and accept the fact that there are going to be people who are going to be infected. And I think that's, again, it goes back to, actually, I like the framework that Governor Newsom put out. The idea is we have to make sure we can take care of the vulnerable people without exposing them to the idea of this kind of up and down incidence of the disease, and the fact that we may have to shelter in place and then not shelter in place for a little bit in order to keep it at a dull roar. The other part, though, is I'm very optimistic, Scott, because I believe in America. I believe in science, I believe in capitalism. It's like there's a lot of people out there really working hard to come up, if not with a vaccine, with treatments that will mitigate the disease. So just the two drugs that I mentioned, if we could prevent someone once infected from getting a really raging infection, if we could prevent someone who has a pneumonia from getting a really raging pneumonia and needing an ICU, we can afford to let people get the flu, right? Because you feel like you've had a really bad flu for 80% of the population, or not such a bad flu, but you know, it's worse, you know, if you believe Chris Cuomo on CNN, you know, it's you know, see him in his basement every day, it's, you know, it's a bad flu for most people. But the problem is, because there's such a large percentage who are harmed and such a high mortality, fatality rate, if you're vulnerable, we can't afford to let that happen. If we can cut the top, and I believe we can, the top of the severity off of the disease and direct our mitigation strategies and prevention strategies primarily at the elderly and the vulnerable, we may be able to get back to a semblance of normalcy for some, you know, in a shorter time period.
I'm curious, if someone comes down with COVID-19 and recovers, are they immune at this point to a reoccurrence? We've heard about this antibody research. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm proud to say we are at the forefront of the testing effort here in the state of California. You may have heard that the governor announced that we and UCSD were partnering with the state to really push this forward. We're going to begin antibody testing within a couple of days. We plan to test our entire healthcare workforce and then follow them, because we don't know whether or not, if you have immunity, how permanent, how strong it is. That is, are you totally protected from reinfection? For how long are you protected from reinfection? For is there a correlation between how many antibodies you have and if you are a strong prevention, or is it just yes, no? So all these things are actually being investigated by our public health department. Again, one of the great things about working in an academic medical center, we not only get to ask the questions, we get to answer the questions. So I don't know yet, but we will know in the next few months. We need to desperately not only fill that in, but fill in the knowledge about whether or not asymptomatic carriers, number one, are transmitting the disease and how frequently they occur in the population, in order to know how safe it is to go back outdoors.
Chancellor May, an issue that is popping up all over the place is issues related to food safety and the supply chain that stocks our supermarkets and everything else. And UC Davis at the forefront of the nation's research on agriculture and food. What conversations are the people at the School of Agriculture having with the private sector, but also with each other, on the things that have to be confronted related to the pandemic and our food?
Yeah, so I'm aware of, Scott, some really interesting work out of the College of Agriculture on the animal science side on the possible spillover of the virus into animal populations and various wildlife populations. It's very important work, obviously, because some of these populations do fit into the supply chain for food. And I'm sure that there's work to see what we can do to make sure that the full supply chain from the farm to the restaurant. We don't have those right now. From farm to the grocery store.
We want them back.
We want them back. From the farm to the grocery store is safe and is efficient and is making sure that we get what we need when we need it. So our faculty are world-renowned experts in all these areas, and I'm sure they're making contributions.
And I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, you know, for both of you, I know that your plates have been extremely full, but I'm just curious, and I'll start with you, Chancellor May. What are you doing to recharge yourself, given not just your typical responsibilities, but your responsibilities during this extremely, extremely intense and difficult time?
Well, let me first thank you, Scott, for giving me a chance to get out of my sweats and pajamas today. But, you know, self-care is important. I exercise regularly. I try to make sure that the folks that I love and care about are also taking care of themselves. I try to take some time to do reading and things I like to do, watching Netflix and things when I have some time. But it's a pretty full day for me. You know, my first call every day is a 7:30 a.m. call. And my last one usually is into the evening right before dinner. And then I have to catch up on email and everything else the rest of the evening. So it is a full day, and all these decisions that we're making now are decisions that we have not had to make before. So it's all new territory. Luckily, I will say I'm grateful that I have an excellent team of leaders with me. One of them we have on the air with me here today, David. But the leadership team at UC Davis is second to none, and I wouldn't trade them for anything. And I think we're going to get through this fine.
Dr. Lebarski, what about you?
Well, I'm not going to be very original. You know, I work out in order to like get up from my Zoom conference calls once a day. I have a great leadership team here at UC Davis Health as well. Really committed professionals who are striving to make sure both the population and every single patient that we touch are safe and well taken care of. But sometimes that's not enough. So, you know, we've stopped saying social distancing. We've started saying here physical distancing with and maintain your social connection. Our psychologists have really focused on creating some webinars and extremely well-attended Zoom events of themselves about how to get self-care and how to recharge themselves, right? And it always comes down to the same thing it's always come down to, which is doing something you love and doing something for the people that you love. And at the end of the day, that's what helps.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, and good luck in your work. We're counting on you.
Thank you for having me. Scott, can I just say one thing? I just want to express gratitude to all the first responders, healthcare workers, docs, nurses, technicians, orderlies, everybody at UC Davis Health for all the frontline work they're doing for us. I also want to thank all the folks on our Davis campus that are keeping the campus operational, from the groundskeepers to the animal care workers to the folks that are doing construction. Everybody at UC Davis, thank you.
I think we would all second that. Thank you so much. Well, thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for watching Studio Sacramento. That's our show. See you next time, right here in virtual space on KBIE.
Thank you for listening to Studio Sacramento from KBIE Public Television. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes to help others find it.
All episodes of Studio Sacramento, along with other KVIE programs, are available to watch online at kvie.org/video.
This Studio Sacramento episode is supported by UC Davis Health, where doctors, nurses, and researchers share a passion for advancing health. Learn more about their latest medical innovations at health.ucdavis.edu.